writer's voice. To celebrate our 30 years of on-air service, Virginia Voice's Patty Campbell talks to noted writers about their lives and work.
I'm your host for these programs, Patty Campbell. And tonight, I'm pleased to welcome environmental reporter Rex Springsteen for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Rex, great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Environmental reporter, we're hearing a lot about green and a lot about the environment, but you've been doing this for a long time, before it was all that hot, right?
Well, what happened is that I used to be on the news leader, if people remember the old afternoon newspaper. It merged with the Times-Dispatch in 92, and in 93 we reorganized. And one of the rare occasions where the people there listened to something I had to say, I wrote a memo suggesting we have an environment reporter. We didn't really have one. We had a guy that did it part-time. And lo and behold, they said, sure, you're it. And I've been the environment reporter since 93.
What did you do before that?
Before that, I'm going back to some ancient history. I joined the leader in 79. I covered Chesterfield for a while. But my main job for many years was, they called me the state rover. I was the guy that literally would go from Southwest Virginia to Northern Virginia to Virginia Beach, depending on what the news was, covering a coal strike or a riot or a big trial, that kind of thing.
Now, the environmental reporter, is there a difference between being an environmental reporter and a nature writer?
There is a lot of overlap. And actually, I don't even call myself an environmental reporter. I call myself an environment reporter. It sounds like a small deal, but I'm not an environmentalist in the sense that I don't join any of the groups. I have to cover news stories that get heated sometimes, and I have to be fair to the environment side, the industry side, whatever side there may be. But I do a lot of nature writing. I mean, some of my stories could be State Water Control Board meetings or General Assembly hearings, but the public really likes stories about Richmond's birds and fish and living things, and I get a lot of response from those kinds of stories, and I like doing them, so I do a lot of those.
How do you get on to the stories?
Sometimes people call me, but my wife and I are both outdoorsy. We both, you know, hike around the area. I actually swim in the James River and like to bird watch, and so a number of stories I've just either found on my own or people that I know that kind of run the same circles have told me about. But, you know, last year I did a story about blue crabs in the James River, in the fresh water, in the rapids, not just in the tidal section, and that's because I was out there and saw them, so and found out that that happens from time to time when we have a really hot summer. Another time I was there with my wife and saw some little baby eels migrating up river just last summer. Did a story. And again, actually a guy said, look at that, what is that, baby snakes? And we found out they were eels, and I got some pictures, got a video, had my camera with me, and so I did a story on that.
Well, what have you brought to read for us?
At your suggestion, I brought a little bit of a mix. I've brought a couple of my environmental stories, but I've also brought a couple things from older things from when I was doing other types of things. So it's funny, some of these stories we spend a lot of time on, you research and spend a lot of time, spend days, you know, researching and writing. And sometimes something just happens, you hear about it, and you just get the information and knock it off real fast. And sometimes it looks that way, and sometimes it comes out real well. And this one was one that came together very quickly. Somebody told me about it, and I typed it up that day, and it ran the weekend paper. It's about a falcon, a falcon that died. And this ran March 11, 2007. A feisty little falcon that produced 27 young atop the Benjamin Harrison Bridge near Hopewell has died. The rare peregrine falcon had no name, but observers say it resembled the cartoon character Popeye, squatty, bow-legged, and powerful. He was small, but he didn't act small, said Sean Paget, a falcon specialist with the College of William & Mary's Center for Conservation Biology, which monitors peregrines. The male bird's gray and tan body turned up last month on a road just south of the bridge. The body didn't have a mark on it, said Brian Watts, director of the Conservation Center. Possible explanations for the death include accidental poisoning or an attack by a rival male. The bird was exceptionally virile. After a couple of unsuccessful relationships, it found a long-term mate in 1997. 27 young in 10 years is a prodigious rate for the rare falcons, Watts said. The popular pair, nesting in a man-made box, were the subjects of local news stories. The male was barely half as big as his crow-sized mate, but the bow-legged battler was a terror when defending his nest, Paget said. He didn't care for eagles. He would just chase them all over the place, Paget said. The eagles were about 10 times his size, and he just lay into them. There are only about 20 peregrine nests in Virginia. One pair has nested in downtown Richmond the past 4 years and is acting amorous again this year. A peregrine can live 18 to 20 years, although they often die much earlier from collisions, fights, and other causes. The hopeful bird was 14, proven by a leg band it got as a Norfolk nestling in 1993. Adding to the tabloid nature of the Hopewell whodunit, another male has already moved in with the bird's former mate. Even in death, the pint-sized peregrine has a future in education. State scientists plan to stuff it.
Great story. Yeah. Now, how do you get all of that information? You can't ask the peregrine.
Right.
So...
Well, now I'm trying to remember who told me this thing had died. It was probably Brian Watts. He's the director of this, again, Center for Conservation Biology. He's one of Virginia's top bird experts, and he's been just a good source and contact over the years. He probably tipped me off, so I talked to him. And then, again, this a colleague of his, Sean Paget, is a guy that really does a lot of hands-on work. State scientists were literally... are trying to bring back these peregrine falcons. So they actually monitor the nest, and they go up and put leg bands on the babies and so forth. So they knew very well this pair and this individual. So when the thing died...
So that's
died,
how they knew he had 27 little...
Right. They've been keeping track for all the time he's been up there. And they keep track of all the... Again, it's only about 20 nests, and they keep track of all of them, including a pair we have right here in downtown Richmond that has some young that are about to take wing.
Wow. Read something else for us.
Okay. Now, here's a story of a different sort. And this fan ran in our flare section a couple of years ago. But I'm a Southerner. I'm originally from Norfolk. And anybody, you don't have to be a Southerner to appreciate this, but we've always had these little arguments in the office. Everybody has these. Where does the South begin? Richmond considers itself to be Southern. We were the capital of the Confederacy and all that good stuff. But you'll sense this from the story that in the back of my mind, I've always kind of sensed that we aren't as Southern as we make out to be. So I wrote the story about where the South begins. It's sometimes suggested that Maryland is part of the South because it lies below the Mason-Dixon line. Anyone familiar with the land of Lee Jackson and Ernest T. Bass knows that is heresy. Northern Virginia doesn't qualify either. It's as Southern as a Knish. So where does the South begin? To answer that question, we offer the following signs of the South. The more you see these indicators around you, the more likely it is you live in the South. This list should not be interpreted as endorsing rebel flags or fire ants. It can, however, be construed as supporting Sweet Tea and reruns of The Andy Griffith Show. Note how many of these indicators show up in Richmond, the former capital of the Confederacy, might surprise you. So I'm going to read a few of these indicators of Southernness. Confederate statues. In this regard, Richmond is very Southern. Grits. You can find them in Richmond, but we probably don't properly revere them. The proof? St. George, South Carolina is home of the World's Grits Festival. Water moccasins. Not in Richmond. These venomous serpents start showing up in southern Chesterfield County, where they are as rare as Democrats. Rebel flags. An endangered species in central Virginia. You find a lot more, like kudzu, when you hit Southside Virginia. Waitresses who know that tea means sweet tea, rarely spotted in Richmond anymore. And it doesn't count if they offer sweetened tea. Alligators. Virginia has been gator poor since they left the Jefferson Hotel half a century ago. Like true Southerners, the hide-bound reptiles prefer warmer climes. Start looking in North Carolina. Glorifiers of the Old South. This species can be well camouflaged, sometimes in coats of gray. There may be more in Richmond than you think. Spanish moss. These tangled tendrils, gray as a hag's hair, don't grow in Richmond and barely reach into Virginia at all. This beautiful moss can be full of chiggers, as any Southerner knows. Really good barbecue places. You can find a few in Richmond, but like cypress trees, they don't flourish naturally here. Try Ralph's Barbecue in Weldon, North Carolina. Fire ants. These nasty little ankle biters make mounds bigger than paint buckets, and they swarm like politicians on a rich donor. rarely seen north of southeastern Virginia. Moon pies. Has anyone anywhere really had an RC Cola and a moon pie? Forget this category. Rebel flag shot glasses, towels, and other flag paraphernalia. The cause took a hit when the Stuckey's at Toano closed a few years ago. Try Virginia Beach's resort strip. Civil War nuts. They go well with moon pies and an RC. But seriously, folks, Richmond wins this category big. We beat the competition like Stonewall Jackson kicked Blue Boy butts in the valley. Live oaks. These are the large, spreading trees you see, dripping with Spanish moss, in coffee table books on the south. You can find a few in Virginia Beach while you're shopping for rebel flag towels. Better still, drive to South Carolina. Y'all, used in the singular, as in a belle telling her date, y'all have a seat on the veranda. Another trick category. This happens only in Hollywood. The word is used for dressing more than one person, but y'all know that. Bless his or her heart. In the true South, you can say just about anything if you preface it properly. Bless her heart, Prudence's baby was premature, but the little thing still weighed 9 pounds. Surely this manner of speech still graces Richmond. Escaped convicts. In the true South, an escapee has to wade through a cypress swamp, brushing aside Spanish moss and dodging water moccasins. If a guy sneaks out of the Richmond jail, he can rest on a bench by the James River and watch Yankees paddle kayaks. You can see the handwriting on the wall right above the divan. Richmond's claim to southernness is in deep trouble. The next time y'all hit Petersburg and get on U.S. 460 en route to the Virginia Diner for some ham biscuits and peanut soup, stop and reflect. That road is where the South begins.
What kind of a response did you get to that?
Oh, I got a lot of response. People sent me their versions, their other indicators, and
it's a fun piece.
And people in the office, it's funny, really argue that, stupid people argue that Maryland is part of the South, and I don't buy it, so, as you can see.
Did you just make this up out of whole cloth? Did all of this come out of Rex Springsteen's
brain?
Well,
you know what, no, maybe 80% came from me, but we had another writer who since left, Lindsay Kastner, and we kept saying for years we're going to do this story. She and I would trade ideas and emails and jokes, and then she got too busy to assist me on the story. She suggested a couple of the ideas, and also in a visit to North Carolina, an aunt of my wife who's very southern, she sounds like North Carolina, she gave me the one about bless his or her heart, so we talked some of those over with her. So, but that's reporting, you know, you don't literally think up everything from your mind. You go out and talk to people and get some ideas. Yeah.
Really fun piece. Read some more.
Okay. Maybe this resembles the story about the death of the peregrine falcon, but it's another living thing that died. But this one, this just ran not even a year ago. A huge tree that I had written about a few years earlier died, and I thought it might be fun to write it as an obituary. So, and you know, sometimes we get creative and it flops. I think this worked. I got some good comments from people. So here we go. This ran last December. Big Mama, an ancient bald cypress that reigned as Virginia's largest tree, has died after an unexpected illness. The champ passed away quietly at her home at Cypress Bridge, a remote swamp in the Nottoway River, 80 miles southeast of Richmond. Big Mama spent most of her life engaged in anonymous volunteer work, such as removing carbon dioxide from the air and providing homes for birds and bugs. But in her final 3 years, Big Mama attracted statewide attention for her great size and age. Big Mama was among about 100 leafy stars featured in the new book, Remarkable Trees of Virginia. Big Mama began her career as a seedling long before Columbus set foot in the New World, and possibly during the time of Jesus Christ. That tree was probably between 1,500 and 2,000 years old, said Byron Carmian of Suffolk, a retired horticulture teacher who discovered Big Mama in fall 2005. Others estimated the tree's age at 1,000 to 1,500 years, but no one knew for sure. You don't expect something that old to just die overnight, but that's pretty much what happened, Carmian said. Friends who loved to visit Big Mama first noticed that she was in poor health in fall 2007, when they saw her towering trunk oozing droplets of reddish sap. We sort of nervously joked, it looks like the tree's bleeding, said Tom Smith, director of Virginia's Natural Heritage Program, which works to protect the state's natural wonders. We didn't know what it was, but we didn't think it was a good thing. This past spring, when other cypresses were sporting new, needle-like leaves, Big Mama produced no sign of renewal. I thought, maybe she's just a little slow this year, Carmian said, but there was more to it than that. Big Mama was dead. The cause is not clear, but old trees, like old people, become less resistant to health threats. Carmian said boring insects may have caused the sap to ooze, hastening the tree's demise. Winds had blown away Big Mama's top and most of her large limbs, but the tree had persevered through centuries of hurricanes, floods, and droughts. It's a sad thing, said Smith. It's so rare that we get to see and touch something that is alive and has been around for that period of time. Big Mama was the matriarch of Cypress Bridge, a sort of lost forest, 40 acres of virgin wilderness so remote that no one even reported its existence until 2005. More than 99% of these cypress tupelo forests, named for the trees that dominate them, have been cut in the southeast, experts say. A swamp is a forest that stands in water. Cypress tupelo forests, full of eerie shapes and shadows, are the classic swamps of horror movies and coffee table books. Cypress Bridge was full of monster trees, but the largest was Big Mama, 123 feet tall, with a massive base that flared out like bell bottoms. The base measured 12 and a half feet wide, the size of some fan district rooms. State scientists, not the most easily impressed bunch, took to calling the tree Big Mama. It was pretty spectacular, Smith said. Big Mama was declared Virginia's largest tree in October 2005, supplanting an old tulip poplar in Bedford County. The poplar later lost some limbs to pruning, so upon Big Mama's death, the state's biggest tree title went to a smaller cypress downriver on the Nottoway. Virginia officials plan early next year to buy about 375 acres, including Cypress Bridge, from International Paper and turn the forest of giant trees into a nature preserve. But cypress wood is remarkably durable. Even in death, Big Mama will probably impress children and adults for decades. Nancy Ross Hugo of Ashland, co-author of The Remarkable Trees of Virginia, said, "I'll be long gone, my bones dust, before the base of that tree rots away." And that's Big Mama.
Anthropomorphizing the tree and writing it as an obituary, I think is very emotion-inducing. Mm-hmm. Did you find yourself feeling something about the loss of
this
tree?
I think that's
or would you have anyway?
I think I would have anyway, but I think that's why I wrote it that way. I found, I won't say I cried, I could feel myself tearing up a little bit just kind of thinking about Big Mama. 2,000 years, you survived. Oh, man, you survived the coming of Columbus, the Civil War, all those things, the droughts, the hurricanes. And just when you get declared the state's champion tree, after 2,000 years, you get 2 or 3 years of fame, and boom, you're dead that fast. You know, she died quickly. So, yeah, and I actually did a separate story on this place called Cypress Bridge, this remote swamp in the middle of the Nottoway. It's very inaccessible. The state has since bought the property to protect it, but you really need to get state permission and get a guide to take you in, because it's very hard to find. But once you're in there, it is like a wonderland. There are huge old trees and strange shapes, and these, if you know cypress trees, they make what are called cypress knees, these cones that look like gnomes, and usually they're like knee high. Some of them are 7 feet tall, they're taller than you. So it is a wonderful place. And then amongst all those giant trees, Big Mama really stood out. So I had seen Big Mama, and when I heard she died, I knew instantly, that's a story.
Wow, quite a story. Mm-hmm. Read us another story.
Okay, I'm going to change pace again and go back. Well, this is from 2000. This is we used to run columns. I don't write columns per se. I write news stories, or what we call features, a longer story. But we used to, our standard reporters were allowed to do more columns in the olden days. We had more space. If you had an idea that was something a little bit offbeat, you could do it. And this was a story I did about a family reunion. As you'll see, my father was from West Virginia. He's dead now. But when I was a kid, we grew up in Norfolk and Virginia Beach, and we made these long trips to West Virginia every few years for these family reunions, and I always got car sick. And I mean, back then, there wasn't even an I-64. It was US 60, and once it got in the mountains, there were horsepin turns and cutbacks, and I spent the whole time throwing up, outside the car. So it wasn't that great a memory, but this is a column about a reunion after my parents had moved on. I've got more roots than a kudzu vine on Miracle-Gro. A lot of them grew out of the rugged hills of West Virginia. My father's mother, Zetta Eudora Springston, one of the all-time great names, was a Stannard, as in the founders of Stannardsville, north of Charlottesville, as in Jane Stith Craig Stannard, the inspiration for Edgar Allan Poe's poem, To Helen. I get the Stannard salute, our family newsletter. I bristle at mangled references to Stannardsville. And my most important family duty, a journey every 5 years to Somersville, West Virginia, for the reunion of the Stannard, Bryant, and Carden families. Some of my earliest memories are of these reunions. I recall my parents, my brother, and me motoring from Table Flat Tidewater. Some of my earliest memories are of these reunions. I recall my parents, my brother, and me motoring from Table Flat Tidewater across Virginia on US 60 before Interstate 64 was built. I recall curve after horseshoe curve all looking alike on West Virginia's mountain roads. I recall getting carsick on these mountain roads. Somehow John Denver left out vomiting when he wrote Take Me Home, Country Roads. He probably took that out while he was exaggerating West Virginia's claim to the Blue Ridge Mountains. Back in those days, the old Stannard farmhouse where my father grew up still stood, but barely, outside Somersville in south-central West Virginia. Sleeping in it was like camping out, what Opie of the North Carolina Tailors once called adventure sleeping. Sometimes we would spin off a trip to see Honey and the Rock in Beckley, or to camp in a cabin at Babcock State Park, where bobcats cried at night, and a ranger cheerily swore the hike he led was downhill all the way, while you puffed and climbed. But the highlight was the gathering of scores of relatives, many of whom still lived in the mountains, and many others who had left, as my father did when the Navy beckoned during World War II. We would picnic and play softball and sing corny things like, "Oh, the West Virginia hills, how majestic and how grand." The next day we would worship and sing Rock of Ages and other family favorites at Enon Baptist Church, a small white frame building along a babbling creek and a green bottom ringed by rolling hills. After I grew into adulthood, it took me longer than most, I would meet my parents at the reunions, and my father would introduce me to distant relatives before I could stumble on their names. Zetta Springston died in 1983 at age 95. My parents moved to California a few years ago, and my father is in poor health. But the reunion continues on. So a few weeks ago, I drove with my wife on smooth, straight I-64 and other good roads to Somersville to reunite with family members from Richmond, Harrisonburg, Northern Virginia, and points far beyond. We can be anywhere, like pod people. This would be my first reunion without my parents, and that break in tradition saddened me. More than 100 relatives gathered at a motel conference room where we exhibited old photos and mementos. I'm not much on genealogy, but I read accounts of our forebears and learned that they weren't all hillbillies and ridge runners. One distant relative, Robert Stannard, was a prominent Richmonder in the 19th century and a childhood friend of Poe's. Stannard's mother, Jane, inspired the hyacinth hair and classic face in the poem To Helen. That afternoon, a Saturday, my wife and I drove into the country to the old Stannard home place. The house was gone, but a stone chimney still stood, and someone had put up an attractive sign. This was the place my grandmother, as a widow, raised three boys and a girl on a subsistence farm during the Great Depression. The children grew up to live happy, prosperous lives, mostly in Virginia, while my grandmother stayed on near the farm. That night, the family gathered at the motel, and we once again sang, "Oh, the West Virginia hills, how majestic and how grand." We sang, "This land is your land, and will the circle be unbroken?" Family members played other songs and told stories and jokes. One passed out recipes for salt-rising bread, an old family tradition in danger of dying out. There was an army of small children present, behaving better than children had any right to, and they seemed fascinated by an evening without TV and computers. But many of these relatives were in their 70s and 80s. A few had died since the last reunion. I wondered who would pass before the next one. This stuff didn't seem so corny anymore. Sunday morning, the congregation of Enon Baptist Church let us have the old church to ourselves. 13-year-old Megan Andrew Conis of Arlington, a great-granddaughter of Zetta Springsteen, played the piano, as Zetta had for more than 70 years there. We sang Rock of Ages and Sweet Hour of Prayer, and I love to tell the story. Relatives spoke of the importance of preserving old things, like quilts. Europeans cherish the old, but in America we tear down historic buildings and put up strip malls, said Stannard Swihart, a physician from Fairmont, West Virginia. Our family is like our health, Swihart said. Most people don't appreciate it until we lose it. We have to protect it and never take it for granted. After the service, we filed outside, and people hugged and took pictures, and children frolicked. The reunion was ending. People would soon return to their homes and their worries. I took in the moment like a breath. Cattle grazed on a hillside pasture just beyond a fence outside the church. Beyond the green pasture stood those bluish-green West Virginia hills, those rocks of ages linking us to the past, like quilts and bread recipes and family reunions. How majestic and how grand.
And how wonderful. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. A quick question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a wife. Do you have children?
No kids, no. Just my wife, Kathy. We have three pets. I'll throw a shout out to Windsor, our cat. That's a highfalutin name, but he came to us as a stray we picked up in a little town called Windsor, North Carolina. And I have a snake called Cornpone. It's a corn snake, which is quite docile and doesn't freak people out. And a little turtle named Odie, because he's a kind of turtle called a stink pot, but he doesn't really stink all that bad.
Okay. Well, it's nice to hear about the Springsteen household.
Yeah.
And Rex, it was very nice of you to come and join us today. We've really enjoyed this.
Well, I appreciate it, too. And now you know how strange we are at the Springsteen household. Yeah.
Well, we've been talking with Rex Springsteen, the environment reporter for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.
You've been listening to The Writer's Voice. Listen online or download to your computer or MP3 player at www.virginiavoice.org. Virginia Voice. Connect by listening.